KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Officials just issued new warnings about the high potential for more damaging fires in Los Angeles, where thousands of homes are destroyed and at least two dozen lives have been lost. Damage estimates surpass $200 billion. The city is home to a large Native American population that is also grappling with chaos and uncertainty caused by the fires, but who are also stepping up to help those in need. We'll check in with folks on the ground in Los Angeles after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden designated the Chuckwalla National Monument in California, located near Joshua Tree National Park. The area holds spiritual, historic, and cultural significance to tribes. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland joined President Biden for the signing ceremony at the White House, which was streamed online. In remarks, she talked about the importance of the administration working with tribes.
When President Biden and I first stepped into these roles, we understood fundamentally that tribes must be at the forefront of our efforts to conserve lands and waters we all depend on. Today, I'm grateful for President Biden's leadership. I'm grateful he has listened to tribes and local communities across the country and has committed our administration to conserving the places that are core to our identities and to our shared experiences.
Biden also designated the Satitla Highlands National Monument in Northern California.
This area is also sacred to many tribal nations, who were violently forced to leave their homes. You know, they held ancient ceremonies here. They found sources of reverence and healing here. And they're preserving lands fundamental to who they are and their way of life. Folks, it's important.
Together, the monuments will protect 848,000 acres of lands. A signing ceremony was planned last week to be held in California, but it was postponed due to high winds. Tribal leaders have also been advocating for a third national monument in California to be designated before the end of President Biden's term. Women will hold the majority in the 2025 New Mexico legislature with more than 50%. More women were added after the November election. Among them is Angel Charlie.
We know in our communities what actually is going to work. And so previously when I worked at the coalition, we were a part of a cohort that passed the Indian Family Protection Act. And in that were solutions straight from our community, from people experiencing barriers directly and creating law policy that addresses those. So I see that as the same thing, you know, in this new role that I'm going to have, is when we center the people who are most impacted by law, policy, and systems, that our systems are stronger for it.
Charlie is Laguna, Zuni, and Navajo. The Democrat will serve in the Senate for District 30, which includes a handful of tribal nations in the state. She's a longtime advocate for women and children, including being the former executive director of the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Her role as a state lawmaker will also include issues involving public safety and addressing violence against women.
What's new is that we're a majority female legislature now, and I think what that means is we're going to be more responsive to family issues, community-based issues, because of the experience that all of us as legislators are bringing. And I'm just looking forward to working on solutions that really impact people and families.
Charlie is now the executive director of Illuminative, a national group working to uplift the voices and representation of Native people throughout the country. The New Mexico legislative session begins next week. Five Native young people have been chosen to represent their communities on the national stage by the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. The Champions for Change class of 2025 represents Native nations from across the country, including Alaska and Hawaii. Their areas of focus include improving indigenous healthcare systems, environmental rights, cultural representation, and art and literacy. The program was launched in 2013 to highlight positive stories of impact from Indian country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Forward Scholars Fund scholarships are open now. Native Forward supports Native students' higher education journeys, offering over 40 scholarship opportunities, programs, and resources designed for Native students. Info and applications at nativeforward.org who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Almost 90,000 people remain under evacuation orders in Los Angeles today, and nearly that many are warned about possible evacuations as officials brace for the possibility of additional fires fanned by strong winds today. More than 12,000 homes, businesses, schools, and public buildings are destroyed so far. At least 24 people have died. More than a dozen more are unaccounted for. Today we're going to hear from people who are experiencing the Los Angeles fires, residents who are working to save their homes and are helping others who are also affected. We'll also find out the unique issues that go into fighting such a fierce disaster in an urban setting. We'll also take time to address harmful misinformation in the form of political rhetoric that has surfaced. You can join this conversation too. Call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-996-2848. We have a number of guests on our show today, three of whom are located in the Los Angeles area. And first up from Altadena in Los Angeles is Courage Escamilla. He's an activist. He's Tarahumara and Lakota. Courage, hello, welcome to the show, and good morning.
Cuerva, and I'm Petawaste.
It's good to have you, brother, and really feel for you and your community. I understand that your house is where the Eaton Fire destroyed a lot of homes. Can you take us through that experience, what it was like evacuating and finding a place to stay?
Yeah, I live in on the very top of lake, like almost in the worst area in Altadena. Currently, it's being blocked off by National Guard. No one knows when we can go back, but it was very, very sudden, the night of, on the 7th of January. So, like, what happened is that I was hearing a lot about the Palisades fire, and so I was keeping an eye on that. It was just horrible to see. And then all of a sudden, like, it popped up on my watch duty app saying, like, oh, there's another fire called the Closer Fire at the time, and it was over by Eaton Canyon. And then, like, not even 30 minutes later, I just get I was even thinking, like, oh, I should pack my bags. I should kind of be ready just in case tomorrow it gets really bad, because I learned about just the day before that there was going to be these strong winds up to, like, 80 to 100 miles per hour gusts. And then literally not even within, like, 30 minutes of finding out about the Closer Fire and having that literally just pop up on the map, I got a message saying, get out now. There's an evacuation. And so there was no time to think about it. Thankfully, though, like, part of my story is, like, you know, I was homeless in L.A. for about 3 to 5 years. I've lived in about 13 different places. And so when you have that kind of instability, you get really, really used to always knowing, like, this is the most important stuff in my life, always kind of being ready for disaster. A lot of that's kind of PTSD. So it was actually rather easy for me to, like, get everything together and knowing what I could save or not. I only have a motorcycle, and so it was very scary knowing, like, how I was going to get out. There was two people I was hoping to depend on for their cars, but they ended up not being available at all, and so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But thankfully, a neighbor actually knocked on my door, who had never done so before, and offered me a ride to help take my stuff. And so thankfully, I was able to get my most valuable possessions out. And kind of my rule when it comes to, like, stuff like that, especially, like, in this very materialistic colonized society, where it's like, if you can't replace it with $1 million, that's something that you truly do deem as irreplaceable. And so I was able to get out fairly early, around 8:30 at night. I had a friend. I was going to stay with another friend, like about a mile and a half away in Altadena, but apparently that ended up not being far enough. So when I got there, I said, like, you need to evacuate as well. So I ended up in Old Town Pasadena, where I've been hosted by some very, very kind and loving friends who have been super supportive of me and have allowed me to do a lot of things to also help my community, like, right away. But either way, though, it's what's most terrifying for me is that, like, if you, excuse me, if you lose everything, that's one thing. And it's a feeling I really could not begin to understand or think to understand. But it's another kind of psychological torment to, like, have a house that's still standing. But from what I know, about 7,000 structures were destroyed in Altadena, almost the entire town. And there was only about 100 homes that survived. Mine was one of them. And so just the torment of, like, every single moment thinking about what's going on up there, is the house safe? I went back the very next morning, and I spent 2 extra days and 2 extra nights helping my neighbors save each other's homes. And the very first night was incredibly scary because I had 2 people try to break into my home. And so, like, now, after this time has passed and I've come back, I think about every hour of every day, like, is it safe? Because no one's really accountable over there. They say that the National Guard is looking after it, but it's like they have no legal responsibility for, like, what happens to the houses up there. And so anything can happen. And if you're looted, if someone commits arson against your standing house, nothing, there's no follow-up, there's no accountability, there's no rebound. And so it's like, that's kind of what I've been dealing with. It's been a traumatic experience, of course, life-altering experience, but I'm doing my very best to, like, stay strong, but also, like, use my background as an activist and a community organizer to, like, do some really big things right now to, like, help everyone else out who is in a much worse position than I am.
Courage, I applaud your bravery and your commitment to your community. Tell us about some of the efforts that you have going on to help others who maybe have lost their homes or who are also going through some really tough times right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing that I didn't quite realize on this level, when you experience a disaster like this with so many other people especially, is that the amount of information that you think would be always good, which is, like, you know, food banks and where to shower and free this and discount that and signing up for this and this organization and that kind of law firm and yada yada. It's like, it's so much. It is so much information. Like, it's just been kind of like, you know, rapid fired at me. And so what I've been doing is that I've made a group of all my friends that I know of in the Altadena, Pasadena area. And I got, like, a Facebook chat kind of thing. And I've been sending all of them every single thing that I've been finding, like, giving them as much information as possible, but kind of at least giving them, like, a preface of, like, everything that I'm sharing. So then I've been working with some other friends in Altadena who are also organizers. And we've been creating these big, huge Google Docs and spreadsheets listing every single GoFundMe that we can find that that people are sharing with us. Families affected, individuals affected in the area, as well as a big Google Doc that has, like, every single, like, a link to every single thing that we're finding, every kind of legal resource, shelter, food, discounts, organizations reaching out that people would want to know about, that's all kind of organized in one place. So we're still working on that. It's a lot of work. I just came back from the FEMA location yesterday, and I came back with just, like, 50 to 100 sheets of paper that I organized last night. I'm going to be scanning them today to put them onto that Google Doc in the form of digital documents so people can see that and understand, like, all of what their options are. Because, again, I have some people where I've been trying to help them, but it's so overwhelming, just the amount of information that you're surrounded by, that it's just, you wish that it was all centralized, even though that's not really possible. So I've been using my background with organizing and just computer knowledge and stuff like that to, like, make it as easy as possible for anyone who is overwhelmed and doesn't have quite the skill set that I do or that others do.
Okay. Courage, what about income? Is this impacting your ability to make a living right now?
Oh, big time. Most of my income came from either organizing people's homes or voiceover. I had a voiceover studio at my place. And so, of course, you know, I can't do anything not being home. And I did almost all of my work with voiceover and other things related similar to that at home. I was able to, I packed up my microphone. I packed up my interface, which is like the thing you connect your microphone to connect to your computer. But of course, you know, I'm in no place to record. I had to like tell both of my agents for commercial and voiceover I had that like, hey, I don't know when I'll be able to get my life back together again. And I just need you to work with me and just as I just get back on my feet. And so like, it almost kind of feels like it's going to be a full year until I'm able to work with my agents again and like them sending me any kind of auditions or opportunities and being able to like take advantage of that. So thankfully I was able to, you know, save like my basic equipment. I don't have any of the actually cords and everything, and let alone like the recording environment. And so, and I'm in no place right now where I can record. So it's like my, all the, you know, all the means that I've used to make a living are no longer available to me. But thankfully I have a place, I have food, I have the basics. Thankfully I have my motorcycle with me. So I mainly just been using like 80% of my time, if not more, to just go out in the community and like organize, help best I can to like just rebuild, but also defend my town. One more thing I wanted to mention, I forgot, is that this Saturday at noon, there's going to be what's called the Build Back Vintage organizing efforts, where it's one thing to talk about rebuilding. It's another thing to talk about like helping people that are displaced and right now. But you know, I think the most important thing, and I know Native people will understand this, is that in disasters like this, especially when the entire town has been leveled, big corporations, big interests, powerful people are going to come and swoop in and try to take advantage of our situation, buy up our land, take advantage of tax law and town policy and things like that. And they're going to try to basically turn our town into something that they always wanted to see it as. And they're going to like they're going to push out residents, even those who have been here for generations or decades. They're going to make it to where our small businesses can't return, or they're completely eclipsed by these giant corporations and businesses now that are going to be placed in our area. So we're now organizing to start that process now and defending as well as rebuilding Altadena, because what's worth going back and rebuilding if it's not going to be anything like it was before in all the worst ways? It's pretty much the same as like never having it back ever again.
All right. Kirch, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk with another person who is based there in the Los Angeles area. Stay with us. As Donald Trump's inauguration nears, his promises to undo his predecessor's political agenda is coming into better focus. Trump has promised a slew of executive decisions on his first day in office. We'll look at how Native nations are preparing for those actions as Trump's term draws near. That's on the next Native America Calling.
We sought to live better, set realistic goals. List the steps you'll take to achieve them. Not sure where to start? Contact your local Indian healthcare provider. Visit healthcare.gov/coverage or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service.
Hey, 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 hey
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. We're checking in with residents and others affected by the fires in Los Angeles, and you can contribute to the conversation as well. How are you or your relations being impacted by the fires in Los Angeles? Is your Native Nation, is a nonprofit that you work with, or your community offering help? Let us know. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our next guest, Johnny J, joins us now from Hollywood. She is the founder of Grim Native. She is Oto, Missouri, and Choctaw. Johnny J, hello. Welcome back to Native America Calling. However, I wish it was under better circumstances.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. I'm lucky right now. I'm not surrounded by what a lot of you folks are going through. We just heard Courage describe what it was like for him having to evacuate his home on short notice. Did you also have to evacuate?
Yes. So, and it's kind of funny because people had been checking in on me with the fires, and, you know, I'm down in Hollywood. I live right off Hollywood Boulevard, so I was pretty far away from the Palisades fire and also from the Eaton fire. So I was like, you know, we're okay. And I took a nap, and when I woke up, we could hear a lot of commotion going on outside, and we could hear our neighbors like pretty speeding out of our apartment complex, and we could hear them talking. And my partner was like, I think I need to go find out what's going on, because we could hear helicopters, and, you know, it just seemed really chaotic. And he goes outside and starts talking, and there's a fire, and just down the street from where we live, the Hollywood Hills had caught on fire, and this was the Sunset Fire. And so, you know, like, I was like, what? And so, like, I kind of had to go down there to see it, to believe it myself. And I get down there, and, you know, you just see the flames, and they're really close to where we are living. And as I was taking my photo of the fires and, you know, kind of texting my sister and everyone to let them know that, you know, oh no, we got the order to evacuate. And being here right down in Hollywood, traffic is always a problem. And so we were trying to get out really quickly to not get caught in the traffic. And because people were already leaving and it was already starting to build up. So we came back in and we started getting things together. And, you know, like Courage said, like, you know, you kind of just have to take what you know is important. And, you know, we took clothes, we took the basics. I have a lot of medications that I take. I have lupus, and I also have diabetes, so I have insulin. And so, like, I was trying to gather up my meds, anything that I needed, so that we could get out quickly. And we got out pretty quickly. We got out before the traffic got really bad. It still took us, I'd say, maybe an hour or so to get to where we are going down in South Central to my partner's aunt's house, where we are going to stay for the night. And it was just really, you know, I hate to keep saying chaotic, but it was really chaotic, because you start to realize, like, you prep for these things. Like, you know to be aware that there's natural disasters, and, you know, people talk about go bags. And I teach survival through the lens of zombie survival, but I teach a lot of this about how do you survive in different events, emergencies. And so I thought we were doing pretty good. But the one thing that you really forget is that sometimes the danger isn't necessarily the fire or things. It's other people and how they are reacting to that emergency. As we are driving to my partner's aunt's, we almost got hit twice by people who were panic driving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just trying to really rush and get out of there. And you kind of understand that panic because you don't know what's going on. And so, it was just really you don't even have time to really think or really assess what's going on in there. And it wasn't until we actually left too that it kind of dawned on me, like, if something were to happen, you know, I didn't grab my mom's beating box, which my mom passed away, and, you know, I still have some of my regalia, and I was thinking of all these things that are going to be lost that can't be replaced, you know, no matter how much money, those things you can't replace. Photos that I didn't think to grab because they weren't a necessity. You know, you start thinking about that and it starts hitting you like, oh, like I'm losing this and it's not something that you could get back. And, you know, we are very fortunate that they were able to knock that fire down pretty quickly and we were able to return home the next day. But it really put it into perspective what is happening here in Los Angeles, what people are going through with losing their homes. You know, with the Palisades fire, people were literally having to run out of their homes. People left cars on the highway because it wasn't moving and the fire was coming. So they had to get out and literally run for their lives. And people don't really understand like how traumatic that might be. And just knowing that there's nothing that you can do, you know, that all you can do is just wait and there's no guarantee of what's going to happen. And that uncertainty is really what's kind of driving so much of the fear, you know, because it is scary. You know, we've already been saying for years that, you know, any one of us are just a paycheck or a hospital away from being homeless. And here's a fire that has put thousands and thousands of families into that situation overnight. And there's no guarantee that, you know, even if they had insurance, is that insurance going to pay out? Is it going to be enough?
Right.
You know, how do we get put back into a home? You know, and you're going to have to wait for, you know, people to go in and assess the damage, for them to start processing claims. So people are going to be in this situation where they may not have a home, where they may be in a tent or in shelters for an extended period of time. We've already seen this with other natural disasters that have occurred here in the U.S., in North Carolina, in Florida, where people who have lost their homes are still in tents, even in the dead of winter, you know, and it takes time. And people, there's no overnight fix for this. And that's a very scary thing. And, you know, it's been really good to see the communities really pulling together. You know, I was down in Pasadena yesterday and there were so many volunteers, young people even just going up to volunteer to help do cleanup, to help serve food, to make deliveries, to where they're delivering like care packages, taking things out that firefighters might need. You know, it's really good to see the community pulling together. But it also brings up a lot of conflicting emotions as well, because we were already a city in crisis with a record number of homelessness. And, you know, it, to see this mobilization happen so quickly, it makes you realize that we could easily mobilize to address all these other issues at any other time, and yet we don't. And so, you know, it kind of brings up the idea of who are we deciding is more worthy of that help than others. And it's really conflicting because, you know, and it's also like kind of recognizing the privilege that you have too. You know, your home survived, you have a home, you have a place to go to when so many others don't. And there's a lot of guilt that comes with that. And also it kind of also drives the desire to help in any way you can. You know, okay. There's so many organizations that are helping. The United American Indian Involvement has a shelter and they've been taking donations. Coffee's Burning Shop. Bernie's Coffee Shop has been really wonderful with taking donations, and they are also a place where if you are disabled, if you have any equipment that you can donate, if you have insulin, preferably the pins, which are more stable, you know, those are needed as well. So if you have those supplies, you know, look into the resources that are available. I've been sharing some on my platforms online, but also like there's also a lot of GoFundMes that could use some help for families that need help, you know, rebuilding and just finding a place to stay.
Oh, geez. Johnny J, thank you for all these updates. We have a caller on the line, and I want to take this call here, but I want to take a step back. And you mentioned how you do these presentations on how Native people could potentially survive a zombie apocalypse. And is it similar now that you've actually lived through this and comparing to what you do in your training? Does it measure up? Did it adequately prepare you?
It does. and, you know, and I saw this through COVID because, you know, there's so many things that I do in these presentations, but the big one is talking about how we as Native people have survived colonization, mm-hmm. how we're still here against, you know, the maximum efforts of the U.S. to annihilate us. You know, we're still here and we're starting to thrive even. And the workshops that I do, you know, I go through like four areas, which are our strongholds, communication, weaponry, and like medicine and foods. And, you know, when you look at the way Natives have survived and have been able to adapt, you know, it absolutely prepares you for these things because you realize, like, we do have a community and we work together as a community to make sure that we give people the best chance that they can to survive. And in the aftermath of this, you know, you absolutely see that work being done in the community. And so it does prepare you and, like, it kind of gives you a little reassurance, like, okay, you know, we're not okay, but we'll get there because you know that those people are there doing that work and that you know that you have that community to return to and that, you know, it's not the end. It's just a start of a new beginning.
All right. Johnny J., you stay strong, okay?
Thank you.
You bet. You bet. Take care of yourself and take care of your loved ones as well. We've got a caller on the line right now. In Pasadena, California. This is Lauda El Sardo, and she is at the Pasadena Community Job Center. Hello, Lauda.
Hi. Hi there.
Hi. Hi.
So, hi. We are on day 8 at the Pasadena Community Job Center. We are here with the day laborers and so many volunteers responding to the fire emergency since last Tuesday that the winds have started here.
Well, give us some updates. What are you folks able to accomplish right now?
Well, right now we have a fire brigade, which is there is day laborers and also volunteers. It has been overwhelming and heartwarming the amount of response that we have had from so many people towards our community, the migrant community. So our day laborers have been working on the cleanup crews. They are going out every day to clean up the streets, the sidewalks from all the trees and the debris that the winds and the fires left.
Okay, good to know. We have listeners on our show from all across North America. What would you like to tell them? What do they need to know? What are they maybe not understanding about the significance of this tragedy?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of things that are happening to our community right now. We work with day laborers here. So first of all, we're full of gratitude for all the day laborers and the volunteers that have been helping at this moment and are helping at this moment with the fire brigades and the sorting and distribution of the donations that we have received. As I said, it has been like heartwarming to know that there is so many people willing to help the community, right? So there has been a lot of consequences. It's not just like, for example, as the day laborers have not only, some of them have lost the place where they live because they live in this area and they work at Pasadena and Altadena. So I'm talking about like the Eden fire, which is like the area that we're working with right now. So they have been affected not just by losing their homes or the place that they live at, but also because their bosses have lost their homes too. So they're right now they're going through a difficult time without no jobs because the bosses have lost everything. So that have left the migrant community without jobs too.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that we are that we're seeing right now here at the job center.
Okay.
The other thing is that, like, you know, like, we will keep doing this work because our thoughts are that only the people will save the people, right?
Right, right. Yeah, Lauda, thank you so much for calling in. And it's just really, really inspiring to hear you and the other folks on the show today, just all of the efforts that you folks are doing just on behalf of your community. So please keep up the good work, and thoughts and prayers to you and everyone else. And let's go to another guest on the show today who is also in Los Angeles County specifically. This is Pamela Villaseñor. She is the executive director of Puku Cultural Community Services, and she is a member of the Fernandinho Tataviam Band of Mission Indians. Pamela, hello. Welcome to the show.
Tommy and Matt, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, tell us more about your tribe. Do you folks have any significant locations there, tribal lands that are in the fire zones right now?
Yes, we have a number of tribal lands that have been in the fire zones, people who have lived in evacuation level 3, level 2 areas. There's been significant power outages. I live under a power outage alert, and even coordinating this call today, we had to see if our phone lines were going to be up or our internet. And I think that's really been the story of so many people, both those of us from the local land-based tribes, but also the largest urban Native population here in LA. And what's great about the experiences your previous callers have shared is that it shows that Angelenos have demonstrated our collective resilience with a fast response to need, from individual community organizing to these community relief centers, from everything from individuals going out and feeding the tribal fire crews that have come to LA. And I know with my agency, Puku Cultural Community Services, along with my tribal nation, the Fernandinho Tataviam Band of Mission Indians, we've reactivated our fire disaster assistance fund to help people during this devastating time of wildfires across Southern California. You know, many families and individuals were forced to leave their homes and memories behind. And so we are helping them with financial assistance so they can pay for things that maybe people don't think about. Hotel rooms, gas for transportation, replacing all the food in your refrigerator when you're facing a multi-day power outage, to people who are going without their paychecks because their businesses are closed. And I think many of us are still under those alerts and thinking about what comes next. Even the fires right now, we are under red flag warnings where I live because the winds are so strong. And, you know, these winds are very dangerous. My agency, Puku, operates the only tribally operated cultural center in the Angeles Forest. That's Hautamacunga American Indian Cultural Center. As of today, it is still standing, but the Angeles National Forest has been severely impacted by the Eaton Fire, which is the same fire that has decimated Altadena. So many structural losses for families. And in the last 2 days, we are just getting alerts and getting and monitoring the situation and understanding that while all our personnel are safe and not on site, we're concerned with the Native collections there in our visitor center, collections that represent the local tribes who are not only surviving these fires, but maybe have a different relationship with the land and seeing their homelands on fire.
All right. Pamela, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk with you more along with some other guests we have on the show. So listeners, stay with us. We will be right back.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. The Alaska Native Art Auction Gala is March 21st, 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Please consider donating art and help Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation raise needed funds. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation's mission is to be the leader in bringing Native voices to Alaska and the nation. With your support, we're able to produce such programs as National Native News, Native America Calling, and more. Donor forms and more information about the auction can be found at knba.org. Anyone who donates art before February 14th will be automatically entered into a drawing to win $500. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AmeriND.com.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
We're glad you're able to join us on Native America Calling today. We are hearing about the devastation and efforts to respond and help in light of the fires in Los Angeles. We're also going to hear more about rhetoric that's emerged during the fires as well. One of our guests today, Pamela Villasenor, is in Los Angeles County, where she's the executive director of Puku Cultural Community Services. And Pamela, before break, you talked about the concern of cultural artifacts or other types of valuable cultural assets, native assets that are potentially at risk. And also, I'm curious about the families, your tribal families. What are they most concerned about right now? And what are they most concerned about for the future as we look ahead in the weeks to come?
Many of our families have not suffered complete loss. We do know that we have a number of our local land-based tribal members who are under certain evacuation orders, have lost power. And one of the things that is important to note is as we hear about having a go box ready, which means all your important documents or whatever is vital that you don't want to lose in the fire, also is to having regalia stored somewhere where you can go. I know that my regalia is stored right next to my go box because I live in a very high-risk fire valley. But I think something to keep in mind is that LA County is home to more Native Americans than any other county in the country. And many Angelenos, whether they're from the local land-based tribes or part of this larger urban Native population, are experiencing these power outages and evacuation orders and probably this collective anxiety. But also remember that before the fire, we already had a number of unhoused relatives living on the street yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And so our agency co-founded the American Indian Alaska Native Community Housing Collaborative right here in LA to work on addressing the disproportionate number of Native Americans going unhoused in LA. And just these past couple of days, our agency has been packing utility backpacks, wool blankets, heavy-duty water bottles, and other items to disseminate to all our unhoused relatives who were already living in a state of emergency before these fires. So we are addressing the wildfires and the impact of these winds on our community, but also keeping in mind that settler colonization continues to exacerbate different problems for the largest Native population in the country.
All right, Pamela, thank you also for joining the show. I'm sure you have about 1,000 things to do today, and taking time to join us is one of them. So thank you. Really appreciate it. You take care of everybody there in your community, okay?
Thank you.
You bet. You bet. Let's go to somebody who can now provide us with some expertise in terms of what it takes to fight a fire of this magnitude. Joining us now from Warm Springs, Oregon is Bodie Shaw. He's been on the show many times. He is the Deputy Regional Director for the Northwest Region of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He has an enormous amount of experience in fighting fire. He's also a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Bodie, hello and welcome back to NAC.
Good morning, Sean and guests. Thank you, Sean.
Absolutely. Well, what can you tell us? I know most of your experience is fighting fires in rural areas, in mountains, in big prairie areas. We're in an urban area here in Los Angeles. What's the difference?
Thanks for the question. First, I want to, hearts go out to Courage, Johnny and Pamela, what they shared, what they've been through. You know, in Indian country, we deal with fire nearly year round, but in the LA area, this is a first in January. And I think most folks recognize that. First wanted to at least share my thoughts and sentiments, which I'm sure many of your audience is doing the same, but Sean, it is quite a difference. You look at Southern California, roughly 25 million people live in Southern California. That's more than the continent of Australia. And as many of our listeners know, we've done Australia Fire Aboriginal comparisons before, but that just gives some great insight into densities of some of the populations in Southern California in a very fire-prone situation with chaparral, which was really the vegetation that carried, and some of the eucalypt trees carrying this fire. And when you get winds 170 to 100 miles an hour, there's nothing that is going to stop that. Even the best prevention methods are very hard. It's nearly impossible, as we found out with roughly 40,000 acres burned by the half a dozen fires, starting with Palisades, Eaton. And really the biggest difference that you normally see in Indian country is that we're much more remote. Our tribal communities, yes, constantly under threat. We've lost portions of our tribal communities over the years with wildland fire. So much of what Courage Johnny and Pamela were mentioning about the impacts to our communities, Indian countries felt it for decades due to, once again, the increase in fire intensity, a changing climate. So, you know, we're happy. We have provided a lot of resources down to Southern California on this event, and Indian country does step up continually, Sean.
Tell us more about those resources, Bodie. I know that many tribes have fire crews ready to go at a moment's notice, and they will travel as far as they need to. Can you tell us about some of the tribes that are represented down there right now?
Yeah, I sure can. And once again, this goes back to the longevity of our fire seasons. We could look forward to a 6-month fire season, then firefighters go their separate way, take some time out. We're really year round now. So, which lends, there's a double-edged sword there, but lends to our ability to tap into our firefighters. I'm going to talk about the Eaton Palisades fire. Hoopa Valley, Northern California, have sent a number of resources. A number of BIA dispatchers have also come in. Fond du Lac, Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, coming from as far away as Minnesota. Grand Ronde out of Oregon has sent engines down, as well as personnel. Minnesota Agency, hopefully we get a chance to hear from former Chairman Don Gentry. Klamath Tribes have also sent down resources, as well as the Navajo Scouts. So once again, Sean, to your point, Indian country has stepped up. We know we have urban Indians in that area. We also have traditional lands of many of the Southern California Indian tribes, bands down there as well.
All right, Bodie, thank you so much for the update and letting us know what tribal communities throughout the country and other parts are doing to contribute and help with the fires in Los Angeles. And you mentioned Don Gentry, and he is a guest on the show. We're going to introduce him in just a moment. But before we do, let's talk about misinformation related to the fires that targets tribes in California. President-elect Donald Trump sent a message saying that efforts to save an endangered fish in Northern California is responsible for a lack of water to fight the LA fires. A Fox News commentator went a step further, blaming the removal of dams along the Klamath River as taking away water that could be used for firefighting. Here is Jesse Waters on his primetime show, January 8th.
Gavin's been tearing down dams. Why? Because the Indians wanted some of their river back so they could catch salmon. Gavin didn't just knock down one dam for the Indians, he knocked down all four. And these dams were a go-to source for firefighters to pull water from to fight fires up north. Gavin's literally tearing down Western civilization for fish and Indians. Nothing against the Indians, I love the Indians. But really?
Nothing against the Indians, I love the Indians. Geez, I love Indians too. Don Gentry on the line right now in Chiloquin, Oregon. He is the natural resources specialist and former chairman of the Klamath Tribes. Don, hello and welcome back to Native America Calling. It's a pleasure to have you always on the show.
Sepkastia, thank you. Dichin Busan, good morning. Thank you. Yeah, it was certainly a disappointment to hear the rhetoric, knowing that the Klamath River isn't at all connected to Southern California as far as water. I mean, there is water that is diverted into the Central Valley from the Trinity River system, which is Lewiston Reservoir. diverts water down into Central Valley for irrigation, so it goes down that way. But we live here at the headwaters. Our people are from the headwaters of the Klamath River here in Oregon, and water flows out of the ground from springs here, spring-dominated and snowmelt-dominated. So there's absolutely no connection between an opportunity for the dams of the Klamath River, which were removed for a number of reasons, not only because of the salmon and the tribe's interests, but salmon are a part of commercial fisheries. You know, one time the Klamath River was the third highest producing salmon river on the west here, along with the Columbia River system, the highest producing, and then the Sacramento system second. And you know, that wasn't just to serve tribes, but commercial fishermen, recreation fishermen, you know, people on the river. The thing that is so ridiculous, the reservoirs provided very little flood control. They didn't provide any irrigation. They're providing some power generation, but very limited through these old antiquated dams that didn't have fish ladders. When the first dam went in 1912, that's when salmon were cut off to our headwaters. So it is a treaty resource. Our people, when we signed the Treaty of 1864, would never imagine that a dam would go in and stop salmon from coming up to our homeland here for our people to fish and to live off of. So just the rhetoric is such a disappointment, you know. There's no connection. I mean, the owner of the dam, Pacific Core, wanted to remove them because they're old and antiquated, produced very little power but created environmental concerns, blocked salmon. Now we have access to 400 miles of traditional spawning area for salmon, not only for the tribes but for people in the region and for the commercial fisheries. What happens on the Klamath River affects salmon fisheries from San Francisco north clear up to perhaps up to Portland. So it's pretty significant. So just a disappointment. And it just triggers me. You know, there is that kind of colonial attitude that we're way more important than salmon, or we're way more important than the Indians, despite saying he loves the Indians. How about caring for the things that we care about and considering us more significantly?
Mm-hmm. 4 million viewers to that show. It's a lot more people are listening to that show or watching that show probably than are listening to our show right now. But, Don, how effective is it to counter this rhetoric?
Well, it's difficult. It seems like the folks that listen to the rhetoric tune in to hear more of that rhetoric. Yeah, you mentioned just the difference between listeners here on your show versus some of those folks that listen to Fox News. The misinformation is just such a disappointment. You know, it seems like if folks that the listeners there listening to his show, if they knew the facts and could see that there isn't a connection, you know, maybe they'd lose some credibility. But I'm not sure how many folks listen outside that kind of circle of rhetoric.
Do you see misinformation such as this having an effect on any future work or dam removal?
Perhaps. You know, I know there have been a number of dams that are old and antiquated that have been removed across the nation, and they just have created environmental problems and so forth. But, I mean, the other thing that is really disappointing is to hear, like, it's Gavin Newsom that removed the dams. It was a long, arduous process and had to be approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in the process to transfer the dams over to an entity that could remove them. So it was a significant process, and he was supportive of the tribes, supportive of the dam owners to remove the dams. He didn't do it. He supported it, and he was just touting the positive things about the dam removal. So, I mean, who's responsible for what? I don't have a clue what's going on in Southern California and what the governor is actually responsible for. But when it comes to water and water management and water rights, it's a lot more complex than one individual, than a governor has control over. So I don't think he had executive power to make the dams go away, and perhaps to do some of the other things that have been helpful throughout the state to address, putting the fires out.
We've done a number of shows here at Native America Calling with regard to Native nations removing dams, and we've had guests come on the show before and say that the dams are kind of an antiquated form of generating power in many cases. There are better alternatives today. Tell us more about what went into getting these specific dams removed, though, that are in regard to these comments with regard to the impact on the fires.
Yeah, the dams came up for relicensing. When the first dam, COPCO 1, was put in the early turn of the century, our people were promised that there would be fish ladders put in there, but basically the proponent didn't put fish ladders in, I guess because it was too cost-effective. So subsequent four lower river dams that were removed had no fish passage. And to mitigate for that, they're locking off that 400 miles of traditional spawning habitat. They eventually put a hatchery down on the lower Iron Gate Dam. Relicensing basically because they had to provide fish passage, they could do it a couple ways. You know, they could put fish ladders on these antiquated dams that probably weren't going to be around too long, or they could remove the dams, or they can develop a truck and haul system, you know, all those kind of things. But the dams were creating environmental problems, you know, poor water quality, it was affecting the whole system. So it was a long process, and it was tribes and commercial fishermen and environmental groups and fisheries folks. So many folks came together to really move forward with at least providing fish passage, but it culminated in the removal of the dams, which is the best.
Don, thank you. Really appreciate you coming on the show to chime in here at the end of the conversation. We had a number of guests on our show. I want to acknowledge all of them who contributed to the conversation. Bodie Shaw, Pamela Villasenor, Courage Escamilla, Johnny J., and Don Gentry. And thoughts and prayers to all of those impacted by the Los Angeles fires. We'll be back again tomorrow looking at how Native nations and tribes are preparing for Donald Trump's first few days in office. Until then, have a great rest of your day. I'm Sean Spruce.
MFA programs at the Institute of American Indian Arts, IAIA, honor your voice and vision. IAIA is a tribal university whose low residency programs empower artists, writers, and community leaders through innovation and indigenous-centered education. Whether your path is creative writing, studio arts, or cultural administration, IAIA fosters respect, dialogue, and community. Applications accepted through February 15th at iaia.edu, who support this show. Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at indian-affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Once he was never brought me a lousy dime and put it in my hand. So there'll be some changes from now on, according to my plan. He's got to get it, bring it, and put it right here, or else he's gonna keep it out.